Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Got a packed agenda today, and it's going to be really exciting. Towards the back end of the show, we'll be speaking with Jose Luis Valenzuela. He's the artistic director of the Latino Theater Company, and he's the director of The Devil's Advocate by playwright Donald Freed. And I'll tell you, I saw this play a little while ago. It is a killer. It is an amazing play. But we'll be talking with Jose Luis towards the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be speaking with Paul Von Bloom. He's a senior lecturer emeritus in African American Studies and Communication Studies at UCLA, as well as a lawyer and author and a lifelong fighter against injustice and oppression everywhere. And Paul has a new memoir out called A Life at the Margins, Keeping the Political Vision. Really, really interesting book. It's the book, the life story of a man who's dedicated his life to fighting against oppression, like I said. And joining us first up in the show is someone I'm really happy to welcome back. It's Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice, who taught at Princeton University for 40 years. He's an author and the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's always good to be with you.
Yeah, back at you. Well, you know, normally I have you on to talk about what's going on in the Occupied Territories, and this time, earlier in the week, I came across an article that was called Learning from Disaster After Sendai and Fukushima, basically posing the question of Turkey is apparently considering building nuclear reactors. There's this kind of thing is going on in many parts of the world. What the hell's going on here? What was your take on this? Why did you write this article getting into this?
Well, I felt that just as Hiroshima was a warning to the human race about the menace of nuclear weapons, so Chernobyl and now Fukushima is a similar warning about the hazards and catastrophic risks posed by nuclear energy. And the nature of these risks has been suppressed by governmental and industrial pressure groups that hide the real costs and the real dangers that are posed. It was really trying to take account of that reality. It's interesting that the former Soviet Prime Minister Gorbachev, just before the Fukushima events, published a piece on Chernobyl, which occurred in 1986, calling it a shocking reminder of the reality of the nuclear threat, in which he said that the nuclear power industry survives through secrecy and deceit, and has kept private some 150 significant radiation leaks at nuclear power stations over the world.
Oh, boy. And,
We can't trust what we are told in the mainstream media about the prospects for safe nuclear energy and the economic viability of it. It's hidden, for instance, also that the government here assumes liability for accidents that cause more than $12.6 billion in property or personal damage, and they are now offering the nuclear industry $36 billion in loan guarantees in 2012 for new nuclear plants.
Well, here's the question that you posed, and I think it's important to look into, this point about whether or not it actually even makes sense. I mean, Turkey's building this, going after these reactors with the Russians are helping them to build it and all this. They're building the reactors and whatnot. But there's this whole pursuit of nuclear energy across the globe, it seems. It's, you know, among, especially in particular among, there's the question of, there's the people, the countries who are underdeveloped, who are in the third world, who actually are looking for cheap, reliable sources of energy. And then there's the places like Japan, Russia, the U.S., for whom this seems to be somewhat of a different question. But the question that is posed for all of them does it make sense to, you know, given what we know about the, as you say, the unpredictable vulnerability to accidents, which we've seen at Chernobyl, we've seen Three Mile Island, we've seen many things, and it seems like you're saying, okay, we have these insurance policies, but in your mind, is there really an unacceptable risk here?
Yes, I believe it is an unacceptable risk, and it's not only the risk of accidents. There are other vulnerabilities that haven't occurred. We always think about these catastrophic events in retrospect. But the nuclear reactors are subject to sabotage, to terrorist attacks, to bombing in wartime. There are all kinds of additional possibilities that may actualize at some point in the future. We have to think about the future, not just respond to the past. And if we put all that in the balance sheet, it seems to me to be pretty clear that this is something that human society is not capable of doing in a ultra-reliable way, which is the only way that this would make any kind of sense. Mm-hmm. And there is the additional issues that nuclear weapons can be more easily fabricated by diverting enriched uranium or reprocessed plutonium from the nuclear reactor fuel that is used in the process of producing the energy. So it also has inevitable connection with getting rid of the weapons. One can never get the kind of world that Obama sort of promised at Prague in 2009 of a world without fear of nuclear weapons. That's just a vision that would be not possible if this reactor technology continues to spread around the world. And incidentally, China is the country that's embarked on the largest expansion of its nuclear power capabilities.
We're talking with Richard Falk, an emeritus professor of international law and practice at Princeton University, and he is also currently at UC Santa Barbara, and he's the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories of Palestine. And we're talking today about the future of nuclear energy in the aftermath of the terrible Fukushima meltdown in Japan. We're talking about the future of nuclear energy and whether there should be one, and how closely this is all bound up with the scourge of nuclear weaponry and the interests of imperialism and the imperialist system worldwide.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's always posed, and I think as I was trying to get at in the question there, the thing that you mentioned in the beginning of your article, it always seems to be posed around these questions of the countries that don't have nuclear power right now always are cast as they want to get it. You know, and when you look at this situation, you mentioned even, you know, in Japan, for instance, the Tokyo Electric Power Company had a bad reputation in the safety record, and the Fukushima reactors were flawed and overage, and there were all kinds of things being done to cut costs. And that seems to be the reliance of these various more developed powers, these big capitalist imperialist powers. They have their thing is much more in order for their constant competition to cut through a competition with each other, the idea of depending on nuclear energy as the cheapest, most profitable way to go, and damn the consequences, seems to be what's really guiding this. And I was wondering, in relation to that, you know, the idea you mentioned, and this became a question that people in different scientific circles were digging into, as recently as a year ago, whether or not, given all the damage that coal and fossil fuels are doing to the environment, whether or not it was actually, you know, more advisable for people to begin to look at nuclear energy as some kind of alternative.
Yes, well, that was part of the nuclear industry's effort to rehabilitate itself in recent years, is to say this energy is needed. Alternate, safer energies like solar and wind will not be available in sufficient supply to meet that need. And then the only alternative would be either soft coal or nuclear, and soft coal has demonstrated health consequences of a rather severe sort, causing both lung cancer and being subject to periodic mining accidents, so that it isn't a very happy trade-off between the certainties, in a sense, that accompany reliance on coal, which is sort of like relying on automobiles for travel. You sort of know statistically what the harm will be, as opposed to nuclear, where the vulnerability is to these catastrophic events that are hard to predict and may or may not happen for quite a long period of time. So it's a very difficult challenge to society, and that difficulty is compounded by the special interests at work here. What you pointed to, Michael, about the profit motive leading to the suppression of information and the suppression of accidents that have happened in the past, or the cover-up of failures to comply with safety regulations. Same thing happened with BP in the oil rig disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. They either bribed or negligently failed to uphold the regulatory standards and didn't do what was even expected of them to protect the kind of catastrophic accident that occurred there.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things you posed too in your article, which I found really compelling, was when you're talking about weighing the benefits against the risks, and you talk about how all these countries are looking at various things, and clearly they are going up against it. I think there's two aspects to it. Clearly they oftentimes have to go up against the the powers that have nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, and whatnot. But there's also there's also their considerations on a strategic level, and I think the question of strategic context for each player in this seems to be what's defining what they do. For instance, Turkey has strategic interests that might dictate they want to get nuclear energy. Mm. On the other hand, the U.S. and the other various big powers have strategic interests that means they want to really tightly control who has not just nuclear energy but nuclear weapons.
Exactly. And there's been a long-played mind game that the nuclear weapons states led by the U.S. has successfully played on a world stage, namely that the real danger of nuclear weaponry and indirectly nuclear power comes not from the countries that possess the weapons, and in our case having used them in World War II, but rather from the countries that don't possess them. It's the proliferation obsession distracts attention from the real issue, which is how do you get rid of the weapons that the nuclear weapon states possess? And by focusing all this energy and attention on proliferation, you shift the focus and allow the nuclear weapon states basically to be able to retain their strategic relationship to this weaponry while trying to prevent others from acquiring it.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice, who's taught at Princeton for 40 years. He's an author and UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and we're talking about the risks versus the benefits of nuclear power, especially in a world that's post-Japan right now. In terms of, it's not even post-Japan, it's mid. Terrible, terrible goings on in Japan right now with nuclear energy and the reactors and the nuclear plants and all that. Now, Richard, one thing you talk about in here, and it's following up on this last thing you said, there was, in some ways, it is really interesting that they posed the problem as being those who want to develop nuclear energy versus the ones who have developed and distributed according to their strategic interests, who is allowed to have nuclear weapons. For instance, in the Middle East, Iran is not allowed to have them. Israel is allowed to have them. All of these things going on like this. And you posed that you posed this thing as there was a Faustian bargain that was struck. Can you talk about that a little bit, and then maybe we can move into this other thing of who's allowed and who isn't allowed?
Yeah, well, the Faustian bargain was embedded in the Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1968, which is a very widely ratified agreement that has, I think, over 160 countries that are participating as parties. And that bargain is that the nuclear weapon states agree that they will seek in good faith nuclear disarmament and beyond that even general and complete disarmament. It's a quite radical commitment if one were to take it seriously, while in exchange the non-nuclear states, by foregoing their option to develop weapons, would be given access and the benefits of nuclear energy technology, and that they would be allowed to fully develop their own nuclear power capabilities. And the reason it's a Faustian bargain is, first of all, the nuclear weapon states never regarded their side of the bargain as a real commitment, and the non-nuclear states by acquiring this technology, indirectly acquire at least potential access to the weaponry. It's sometimes been called making these states that have nuclear capabilities, like Japan and Germany, threshold nuclear powers. That is, in a matter of months, they could convert the reprocessed fuel they have into the production of weapons, if they were so inclined.
We have time for one more question, and it's one that I know you dig into very deeply, and I wanted to pose it because you're also looking at a sort of solution, in a sense, and you're saying that the solution to all of this and the issue of nuclear energy itself, as we've been talking about, is in the larger setting of world politics, inseparable from concerns about nuclear weaponry, and should enter into Turkey's assessment of its interests and promotions of its soft power diplomacy. And you go from there to talk about the idea of the establishment of a nuclear free zone, or conversely, you kind of argue, and I think it's mainly done to make a point, is that either it would seem that in a world of sovereign states, nuclear weapons should be prohibited for all, or the security option of the weapon be given to all. And you go on to speak of these things as you present this as the idea as that this is sort of the direction things need to go in order to solve this thing. Can you speak to that?
Well, I say it follows from what we've been talking about, in the sense that we've now had more than 40 years of this non-proliferation regime without any movement toward getting rid of the weapons. So that what I'm implying is that without some kind of incentive given to the nuclear weapon states to change their posture and to really take seriously the obligation to engage in nuclear disarmament, it won't happen. And we're now at a point in international political development of an almost ideal time to try to get rid of the weapons. There's no real strategic rivalry that threatens a major war. There is an incentive to avoid non-state actors gaining access to this weaponry. And you would think that there would be a big push to implement the kind of vision that Obama depicted in 2009, but on the contrary, the nuclear pressure groups have hit back, and he's more or less dropped the issue from his policy agenda, which he's done with a number of other things in foreign policy, including the promotion of a just Palestine-Israel peace.
Yeah, it's interesting because I keep looking at this last paragraph, and again, where you say, after 48 years, it's no longer reasonable to accept the non-proliferation fiction that states that don't possess the weaponry are more dangerous to world order than the states that have the weapons and are continually working to improve their possible uses in warfare. And the idea is that this whole accumulation of weaponry with the capability to annihilate a foreign country is by itself repugnant and unlawful. And I keep thinking about how closely connected the development of nuclear energy is to that, and the idea of maintaining the validity of the use of nuclear energy, given what we know about the risks and that the risks are themselves unacceptable, that this whole idea of a world where nuclear weapons are what determines the power relations in the society, it is repugnant, and it should be unlawful. Unfortunately, in the world we live in, it's not unlawful. It's full speed ahead.
I'm afraid that's so, and it is a kind of sort of Damocles that hangs over the human future, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, Richard, we'll have to have you back soon because I want to talk to you about this Goldstone report and what's been going on there. And I was going to try and throw that in on the size of side question later, but we've kind of run out of time. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Good, Michael. Okay. Glad to be with you always.
All right. Take care, Richard. Thanks a lot. Bye now. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Professor Richard Falk about nuclear energy. Do the advantages outweigh the risks? Absolutely not, according to Dr. Richard Falk, and to me, too. And it should be to all of you. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Paul von Bloom. Welcome back. That's System of the Lost Cause Man, Ghetto Priest. And I thought that was a very, very, very important and apropos way to introduce my next guest, since it's a song about a man who's saying, I will never be part of the system of the Lost Cause Man. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Paul Von Bloom, Senior Lecturer Emeritus in African American Studies and Communication Studies at UCLA, an author and a lifelong fighter against injustice and oppression everywhere. And he's the author of a new book, his memoir, which is a really, really interesting book. And I think it really gives you a sense of someone who's basically chosen to have a life with a purpose and meaning in relation to all of humanity. And the name of the book is A Life at the Margins, Keeping the Political Vision, and it's published by the New World African Press. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. I'm delighted to return once again to your program.
Let's jump into this, because as I read your book, I kept thinking, God, first off, I want to know, we've been kind of doppelganging each other for all of our lives. Okay?
Yes, we have.
You live there, I live there. You live here, I live here. Sort of, and finally, we bump into each other. Anyway, when I was going through your book, the themes in life, you know, the politics figured centrally in your entire life. And I wanted to try and pick out some of the key themes as opposed to just sort of walking people through the entire book. And you basically very early on in life decided that you were not going to have anything to do with a system that perpetrated some of the most heinous things you could see, whether it was from the Holocaust or to racist mobs. And I wanted you to talk about that a little bit and give people a sense of one of the turning points in your life was in Levittown, Pennsylvania.
That was an enormously important part of my life. My father was the only survivor from a Holocaust family, and when he came to the United States, he immediately realized that the same racism that killed his family was the same racism that was oppressing the African American population in the United States. And so early on in my family, I realized that the struggle against racism had to be something that I dealt with for the entirety of my life. But what happened was that when I was an early teenager, my father and my mother moved to Levittown, Pennsylvania, a suburb about 10 or 12 miles north of Philadelphia. And at a very young age, we had a particularly strong set of traumatic experiences, which I describe extensively in the book. I'm happy to talk about that.
Yeah, be good.
Okay, in 1955 or 56, my parents moved to Levittown. It was one of those quintessential post-Second World War suburbs. My father had the GI Bill, so we moved there, and everybody said it was a wonderful place to raise children. I never particularly liked it. I liked the grit of the city, but we moved there, and to my parents' horror, they discovered that the developer of Levittown, William Levitt, refused to sell to African Americans, and my family and several other progressive families decided to do something about that. And in 1957, these really courageous people, my family, my parents included, were able to break the color line in Levittown, and they managed to arrange for an African-American family, Bill and Daisy Myers, to buy a house in Levittown. They were the first black family. As I described in the book, the Levittown Times was kind of a local conservative newspaper, picked that up, and they announced on that hot and sultry day in August of 1957 that Levittown's first Negro family was to move in. And as I also say, it was tantamount to saying that the mob will gather that evening, and that's precisely what happened. I was able to see some of the most repulsive racist conduct you could ever imagine. I think it was August 17th, 1957, when the first African-American family actually moved in, and what it did was to precipitate a series of utterly racist and repugnant riots. And this is just a few miles north of Philadelphia, where our nation began, and it commenced really weeks of horrible racist conduct. They burned crosses, including on my parents' lawn. They referred to us repeatedly as nigger lover. It was absolutely horrific. They had mobs of people outside of the first African-American family. They erected a house with a huge Confederate flag. They blared Dixie outside. They walked a little Cocker Spaniel outside the house, calling it nigger. They had caravans of cars. And the Ku Klux Klan was deeply implicated in all of this. In September, they actually burned a cross on our lawn about 3 or 4 miles away. And as it happened, I saw the perpetrators, who were in fact Klan members. And later that year, in 1957, I managed to testify against the Klan members. And I was able actually to recapture my own testimony against the Klan when I was all of 14 years old. And I've reprinted about a page and a half of that testimony in my memoir. It was unbelievably traumatic, but because I saw that racism so up close, it fueled in me a lifelong hatred of racism, and it catalyzed in me the kind of lifelong struggle to fight racism whenever and wherever I saw it.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Paul von Blum, who recently published his memoir of a life dedicated to fighting against injustice wherever he found it. And the title of that memoir is A Life at the Margins, Keeping the Political Vision.
Well, that's the point I was going to ask you about, because you mentioned later in your book, you mentioned that your commitment to the civil rights struggle is you describe it as your most enduring political commitment. And you said that it was based on seeing the negative impact of racist oppression on black people. Can you talk about that a little? Because I think that's something you and I both shared. You know, I lived in Southwest Philly, and remember they used to call it blockbusting, you know, so you had the nice soft streets of Levittown. Then you had Southwest Philly between Chester and the Penrose Ferry Bridge. And I remember in the projects there, where my grandmother lived, there was a black family moved in, and they called it blockbusting. And hordes of racist mobs came out with Molotov cocktails and everything else. And it was this very similar situation. But it really struck me. I really, really understood what you were saying when you said you looked at the terrible negative impact and an overall dehumanizing impact of racist oppression on black people.
And I knew when I saw that this was something that really fired my passion. All of this was happening at the same time. It was a year later after the Montgomery bus boycott. I watched the extraordinary events in Little Rock in 1957. We moved in 1959 from Levittown to California. We moved actually because my father was branded as a subversive because of his anti-racist activity. In fact, one of the sympathetic families, we thought, turned out to be FBI informers, and they kept reporting the activities, and so my father kept losing his job. And so that precipitated our move from the Philadelphia area to San Diego. And by that time, I was almost ready to finish high school, and I knew in my gut that I would have to really join the emerging civil rights movement. And by the time I got to college, I knew not only that I would have to join it, but that I would have to go south and really take part in a profoundly, vigorous way to be that. And by the time I became a freshman and a sophomore, I got into a car with a friend and we went south. I knew that I really had to put my body on the line. This was such an enduring struggle that I knew I had to be there. I drove south, I think, first in 1962 and rolled up to the headquarters of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and said, "Here I am, where's the action?" And as I describe, they were delighted to receive me but said, "Whoa, you first need to engage in some nonviolent training." But shortly after that, we really became involved in an extremely powerful way in all of the events, like the sit-ins and everything else. And what I've tried to do, in fact, is to carry forth that spirit of activism into my professional life as a university teacher. And I've never abandoned that commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's clear. I mean, that actually was why I picked that song, even in terms of to open this up, because of this idea that, you know, taking a stand and a life with a purpose and a life with a meaning, with a meaning for all of humanity. I think it was really important. And it's striking, too, because you moved from the Philadelphia area to San Diego. And in that move, that actually opened the door to a sort of more consistent, or at least opened the door wider to a radicalization that has continued with you all of your life.
My entire life. San Diego, we shortly discovered, is an extremely conservative place. And when I was there, when I wasn't going south to Atlanta and Alabama and Louisiana, I became very involved in the Congress of Racial Equality. San Diego in the early to mid-1960s was not a particularly congenial place for a civil rights activist. And in 1964, when I was about to graduate from San Diego State University, I found myself very involved in organizing against the discriminatory hiring policies of the Bank of America. And in June of 1964, I was arrested. I'm proud of that, at the Bank of America in the downtown San Diego. And that commenced one of the most traumatic experiences of my own life. I went to trial in the municipal court on three misdemeanor charges that I also describe in the book. And after I was convicted by an interesting jury, all white, every African-American who wasn't called before the jury was summarily dismissed by the prosecutor. And when my attorney, an African-American attorney, objected, the judge said that there was no problem. And because I'm not an African-American, I had no standing to make any objection. The jury was out for about 2 hours and then came back with a verdict of guilty on all counts. I was sentenced to 3 years of probation with an extraordinarily grotesque set of conditions, which I describe. One of the conditions was that in order not to be sentenced to 6 months in jail, I was required to go to law school, which really changed the entire trajectory of my professional life.
I want to get into that, Paul. Let's hold on for just 1 second so I can remind listeners that they're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Paul Von Bloom. He's the author of a really wonderful new book, a memoir called A Life at the Margins, Keeping the Political Vision, and Paul has spent his life fighting against this system and all of the ugly manifestations of oppression it brings down. And he's also spent his life he's the senior lecturer emeritus in African American Studies and Communication Studies at UCLA. He spent his life really fighting to bring critical thinking and education, real education, to tens of thousands of students, which we'll talk about in a second. But I thought that was very interesting that you went to law. Now, this is, you know, a lot of lawyers go to law school and end up in jail, right? But you, to stay out of jail, had to go to law school.
You know, when I was my first year in law school at the University of California at Berkeley, I was watching my fellow law students with the usual kinds of stressors. You know, are they going to do well in torts and contracts? I had a different set of stressors. If I didn't do well in torts and contracts, I would flunk out and go to jail. So I had a different set of problems. Actually, 2 weeks into law school, I found it so preposterous. I saw law school as nothing more than a sophisticated set of ideological precepts that would do nothing more than to help rich people get richer. In other words, the kind of ideological apparatus that would protect capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually left. I went back to the political science department at Berkeley, where I was going to do PhD work, and I actually left. And I knew that the judge would not be happy with that, so I sent him a letter, which I thought at the age of 21 was reasonably tactful, but apparently it was not. And he sent me back a telegram. It's fun when I talk to my students about that, because very few of them have any idea what a telegram really is. And that telegram said that I had 48 hours to get back into law school, or the judge would rescind my probation and issue a bench warrant for my arrest and impose the jail sentence. So with great personal reluctance, I went back to law school, and I actually finished the law school curriculum in 1967 and eventually passed the bar, and I've been a member of the California State Bar for over 40 years. So I have this interesting undercurrent of doing some work as a political lawyer. I've worked with the National Lawyers Guild, you know, kind of on the side, and I've done some political cases here and there. But it's kind of ancillary to my major work as a teacher and as a writer. So it's been an interesting kind of professional life.
Well, let's talk about this thing with education, because that's also been a major battle in your life. And I found that to be really, I was really riveted by the struggle that you had to go through. And this is something that began with your first reaction to the sort of wooden, blockheaded, you know, approaches to education in this country, to the actual, what you've summed up later, and I think correctly, as the brainwashing that goes on. And you fought your life against that and paid a pretty heavy price for that.
I've had a turbulent 42-year career at the University of California. When I was at Berkeley, at Bolt Hall in the law school, that happened to coincide with the free speech movement, and I was vigorously involved with the FSM at Berkeley, probably against my probation order, but so be it. And after the free speech movement, there were a number of us who really were starting to seriously critique education. And I knew that I really wanted to enter it. And actually, after I graduated from law school, I joined the rhetoric department at UC Berkeley. I told them that I thought that I could be a good teacher. It was an arrogant kind of thing that I did. But it turned out to be fairly accurate. The judge, by the way, found out that I started teaching at Berkeley and wrote me, the judge who sentenced me to probation and to law school, sent me a letter congratulating me on passing the bar and then expressing his profound disappointment that I went into teaching and not into legal practice.
Okay.
But I've had an intriguingly rocky road in my faculty career at the University of California. There are a lot of faculty members who are very liberal about the affairs of others, but not quite so liberal about the affairs of the university itself. And I have tried very, very hard to bring a very critical perspective in all of my work. And there have been intermittent times when I've myself come under attack by various conservative forces at the University of California. I have fought them back, and successfully, each and every time, always with the extraordinary support of masses of my students, mostly politically active undergraduate students. And as I keep telling my students, I'm still here. Mm-hmm. I'm still doing it. I taught two classes just this week, one on racism in the law, which is a new course in African American studies, and then my other long-standing class on the history of political art, which is an honors course at UCLA. So I'm still at it, and I intend to continue to be at it.
Yeah, and for the benefit of all of us. And actually, one of the things I wanted to say is that, and it always happens this way, we run up on the time, and I have about still 9 more questions or topics I wanted to get into. But I do have one more question, maybe, and maybe two, to get into, and we have about maybe, say, 3 or 4 minutes to do this. You had a lifelong battle around this contingent faculty status, and that actually, without getting into all the, ins and outs of it, I really thought your idea that you, what you fought for all of your life was not education on a narrow basis. You weren't for training engineers who just knew how to turn screws and put and design machines, but you were actually for people exploring in an all-round way the interconnected disciplines, and you developed a very broad approach to education where people were actually encouraged to know the world. And I wanted to connect that to what you said about at the end of your book, where you talk about that you have no apology for the life that you've led, and it was a life that was rooted in and represents a 60s sensibility. And if we could talk about that in closing, it'd be really good.
No, absolutely. As an educator, I have a thoroughly interdisciplinary perspective that cuts across traditional academic lines, but it goes far beyond that. It says that you don't get educated just to have a broad perspective. You need to take that perspective and apply it to the world. We live in a very, very frightening world. I don't like what I see in this world. What we need to do is not just train people to be technically competent. We need to educate people to a level of critical consciousness so that they can take that education and apply it seriously in a world beset with huge problems. And I'm proud to say that with 40,000 students that I've had since 1967, I've had a huge number of students in a variety of professions, education, law, medicine, and a variety of others, who've really tried to combine their professional lives with a broader commitment to social criticism and change.
All right, Paul, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. We've been talking with Paul von Bloom. He's an educator, a senior lecturer emeritus in African American Studies and Communication Studies at UCLA, as well as a lifelong fighter against injustice and oppression everywhere and against the system that breeds it. And Paul's got a new memoir out called A Life at the Margins, Keeping the Political Vision. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk with Jose Luis Valenzuela, the artistic director of the Latino Theater Company. We're going to be talking about a play that's called The Devil's Advocate by Donald Freed. All right, welcome back. And that was 1-800-HITMAN from Robert Rodriguez's Chingon. All right, and I felt that was really fitting because it's 1-800-HITMAN, and we're going to be talking about a hitman from the Vatican, okay? And that's one of the characters in this new play, The Devil's Advocate, from playwright Donald Freed, said by many to be one of the foremost political playwrights in the country today. And here to talk with us about that is Jose Luis Valenzuela, who's the artistic director of the Latino Theater Company and the Los Angeles Theater Center, and he's the director of this play, Devil's Advocate. Jose Luis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. How are
sure.
you?
Sure. Very good, man. And really glad you're back. You know, we got to do this more often, brother.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Tell people Devil's Advocate. What is it about?
Devil's Advocate, it's about the invasion of Panama and the arrest of Noriega during the invasion. If you guys remember, when they invaded Panama, Noriega, who was the president at the time, asked for a sanctuary at the Vatican Embassy. And essentially, the Vatican sent the Devil's Advocate, which is somebody who has that job with the Vatican, to come and essentially convince him to give himself up to the United States to be tried as a criminal. And that's really what it's about. A fascinating play, as you've seen it, and it reveals a lot of the history of Panama and reveals a lot of the relationship between the church and the state and, you know, and what's going on in order to the creation of these dictators around the world by the United States, and what happened when the dictators decide not to go along with the program, and how we can get rid of them.
Yeah. Well, one thing I found very, very interesting is the fact that the church still does, like this guy, this priest that they sent in to convince Noriega to give himself up to the U.S. at that time. He actually was sort of a papal nuncio, and he was actually had two titles in the Vatican. One was the Devil's Advocate, who mm-hmm. went around, and he went around and was the cat that was supposed to go around and prove miracles were not, you know, really question them, really rake them over the coals to see if they were true. And then his other title was the Grand Inquisitor.
Yeah, the Grand Inquisitor.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is a true story. This really, really happened. It took 10 days in the real story here, and the play is only over one night. But the actual Archbishop and Noriega, who knew each other because he was the Archbishop in Panama before this happened, and he was already retired, they took him out of retirement to bring him to Panama to get Noriega. So it's fascinating and it's so revealing for many of us, even us who know the story, who remember reading it, who are aware, surprisingly, we find a lot of more insight into the story that I was not aware of it.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that. And actually, I read an article by Donald Freed, the playwright. As he said, he wanted to do a play that it was about the politics in the play as opposed to the politics of the play. It was in the play versus of the play. And I was wondering how much this influenced the way that you staged it. You know, I thought that was really good because, you know, it'd be a hell of a job to try and stage an hour and a half, 2 hours, to try and stage a play that dealt with this whole big panoramic, you know, thing unfolding. And in the way you did it, you actually put some stuff in the background that contextualized everything, but it was really about the power politics that were concentrated between the Jesuit papal Grand Inquisitor and Noriega. You know, it was really the devil and the devil's advocate, the Grand Inquisitor and the guy who sort of worked with the Grand Inquisitor.
That's right. Well, I mean, when I read it for the first time, I said, well, who's really the devil's advocate here? Okay, let's discuss. I asked Donald, you know, because they say both of them by revealing their own secrets of each other, you know. These are two very powerful men who actually find themselves being used, you know, by the superpowers, in this case the United States and the Vatican. And happened that they both, meaning one is from Spain and the other one was from Nicaragua, and how they've been used and manipulated in the name of power, really, becomes a big part of the play that they don't understand. And when you see what's going on in the Middle East right now, I remember we were going through that in Latin America during this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were taking down all the dictators, if you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting too, because this thing of what you said about people you know, look, you have these two people who are the two characters in the play, and they're dealing with each other. And in a lot of ways, yes, they're forces that they're being sort of, you know, manipulated by forces much greater than themselves. And it was interesting for people who don't know, or even for people who do know and live through the invasion of Panama and the dethroning of Noriega and all the other stuff, that actually one of the things, the reason they really turned, the U.S. really turned against Noriega, and people have to remember, Noriega worked for the CIA since 1960.
That's,
you know, and the reason they went against him was because he refused to the demands of Reagan's administration that Panama be allow itself to be used as a forward staging base for the Contras in Nicaragua.
That's, you know, correct.
And
that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. And it's very heavy, because when you get that you get a certain amount of truth, and then you get some really stunning truth. And we don't have to give away the end of the play, but I mean, I actually was caught up breathless. I was riveted, sitting on the edge of my seat at the end of the last 20 minutes of the play. It was like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets, and you know how the interesting part about, I mean, Donald Freed, which is one of great American political writers in the theater, you know, it gives us these texts with such great insight and information about, you know, the some of the true events that happen, and already we have these preconceived ideas ourselves, you know, of what a dictator is and what the church does. So the challenge is how to make it engaging to the audience that they find certain humanity in these characters. And that was really the most difficult part.
Boy, I could imagine. And, you know, and I see what you're talking about. I mean, I know in the exchanges between them, and in particular the confessional aspects of things, a certain amount of humanity comes out. But at the same time, you did a really good job, and I guess Donald in an overall sense, but you in directing it did a really good job of not overplaying the humanity, because you don't want to feel sympathy for these characters.
Yeah. <It's> like, no, of course. But you have to understand that they were people who loved to have the power, mm-hmm. you know, who loved and to use it, and to use it against their own people. I mean, this is a big thing about Noriega, mm-hmm. you know. Even though his beginnings, he thought he wanted to be a revolutionary, you know, and what happened, what power is given to you, mm-hmm. and how you transform that power and to oppress in your own people. I mean, and when we find out everything that he says about the invasion of Panama and how they were trying, I think it's interesting because as if they were trying to use laser weapons for the first time and the invasion. And when he's talking about cutting cars, cutting people and burning people, they were using these weapons for the first time, and it was true. I mean, we don't even have an idea how atrocious was that invasion, how many people got killed.
But that's a really important point because, well, first let me remind listeners that I'm talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela. He's the director of The Devil's Advocate and the artistic director of the Latino Theater Company and the Los Angeles Theater Center. Now, Jose Luis, you know, the point that you're raising, I mean, the horror of, I remember being particularly struck when he talked about the laser weapons. And because, you know, I considered myself having followed a lot of that. I knew about a lot of the mass graves. A colleague of mine at Revolution Newspaper had actually photographed some of the mass graves and tried to break it and had the story squashed by the you know, New York Times and whatnot, and yet, but this stuff comes out about these laser beams, and it was very heavy, and especially to have Noriega, and that's the thing I thought was actually interesting, because this point about, you know, exposing the human condition in a certain sense, but the deep and secret conflicts of these characters, like Noriega and like the Grand Inquisitor, you know, and yet at the same time, like you're saying, it's you know, it's yes, these are players in a game determined by an overall brutal system, but they are players, because even the priest used to, you know, base himself on, oh yes, I'm a Basque, you know, revolutionary and all this, and it was sort of,
yeah.
You know, whew, boy.
Yeah, so that was the entire thing that these two revolutionary young men who get captured, you know, by the revolutionary idea and transform into powerful men to be able to serve essentially the big power structure,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how at the end of their life they figure out, you know, man, I did a lot of f***ing damage. I'm sorry I say a bad word.
Yeah.
I did a lot of, you know what I mean? I betray every single value that I began with in my life, mm-hmm. you know, which is devastating for anybody. And how they began to recognize who really, you know, was behind the entire thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I wanted to actually get into, one last thing here, is the way you staged it. You know, I was fascinated because it captured so much of both. You know, you had this very sort of majestic, almost feudal kind of majesty to an apartment that the Papal Nuncio, the Grand Inquisitor, was living in. And at the same time, it was just strewn with trash and whatnot. And it was, and just the lighting of it and the sounds, it really provided a way for the scenes, the center of the play being the relationship between these two people and what this priest was trying to do with Noriega, and Noriega on his own, from his own side, what he was actually trying to do to the priest. It was, you know, you set that in a way in this apartment, setting it in this kind of apartment really emphasized, instead, like I said in the beginning, instead of the outside, you know, you contained the entire thing within that room, and it was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. No, it was really important to because, you know, we have the fan that was really important. That's a very important part of the play where people are listening to what the conversation is.
Mm-hmm.
And all that conversation has recorder, which we could get it, but mm-hmm. because, you know, but the idea that it was important, I know, I seen the pictures of the apartment, you know, it's a small house, really, where this event happened for reals, but in order to, and theater, the metaphor of power has to come many times to the set and the lightings, even though this is really a play about the relationship of these two people and these two powerful, you know, men who had done lots of evil to the world, mm-hmm. both of them, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and in the end, it's a play that really leaves you with a deeper understanding, leaves you stunned, but with a much deeper understanding of things. So, Jose Luis, congratulations on a really, really wonderful play and a really important play.
Thank you so much.
Jose Luis, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you very, very much, Michael.
Okay, talk to you soon. Bye now. All right, we've been talking with Jose Luis Valenzuela, the artistic director of both the Latino Theater Company and the Los Angeles Theater Center. And we've been talking about Donald Freed's play, The Devil's Advocate, the story of how the Vatican's Grand Inquisitor, yep, that's right, they still got the Grand Inquisitor, worked to get Manuel Noriega, the Panamanian dictator overthrown by a U.S. invasion in 1989, to surrender to the U.S. and to be put on trial in Miami, Florida. Noriega stood trial in Miami, was convicted, and remains in a U.S. jail to this day. Meanwhile, imperialists all over the world are lining up to press their own charges against Noriega. In fact, in 2010, he was convicted and sentenced in France to more jail time. And never forget, the same Panamanian dictator, Manuel Noriega, had been a longtime puppet of the U.S. imperialists. In fact, he had been working with the CIA since the early 1960s, and he was one of their favorite puppets until once he decided not to do what they wanted him to do. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And remember, keep on coming back each and every week. You know where you're going to find us? We're right here at the corner of epistemology and morality, the place where if you know something is wrong or something is right, you got to act on it one way or the other. I've been thinking a lot about what we've been talking about today, and I wanted to leave you with this quote taken from the new book, Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. These quotes are something that'll really give you something to think about for the rest of the week until we talk again. So check this one. We've been talking about people grappling with reality, about people rising up and spending their lives doing something that really meant something to humanity. And in all this, each one of us in a lot of ways are confronted with the choice of what we're going to do with our life. Sometimes we wrestle with it for a long time. Other times we just turn away and do whatever comes up. But whatever we do, we should always strive to make it have meaning. A meaning not just for us personally, but for all of humanity and the future of humanity. So this is from Bob Avakian. When I look at all this, I think again of my friend who decided to dedicate his life to ending cancer, and of the even greater need to put an end to the system of capitalism, imperialism, and all the suffering and oppression this system embodies and enforces throughout the world. You see that there isn't anything more important that your life could be about. And whatever you end up contributing during the course of your lifetime is the most important and the most uplifting thing that you could possibly do. And yes, there are moments of great disappointment, but also moments of great joy as part of this. There is the joy that comes from seeing the ways in which people break free of constraints and rise up and begin to see the world as it really is and take up more consciously the struggle to change it. There's the joy of knowing that you are part of this whole process and contributing what you can to it. There's the joy of the camaraderie of being together with others in this struggle and knowing that it is something worthwhile, that it's not something petty and narrow that you're involved in, but something uplifting. There's the joy of looking to the future and envisioning the goal that you are struggling for and seeing people come to even a beginning understanding of what that could mean, not just for themselves, but for society, for humanity as a whole. So this is what my life will continue to be devoted to, and this is what the ongoing story of my life will be about. That's actually taken from Bob Avakian's memoir, From Ike to Mal and Beyond, and it's currently in a book called Basics from the Talks and Writings of Bob Avakian. Pick it up, check it out, it'll rock your world, all right? I hope you enjoyed the show this week. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Rebel Rebel from Ricky Lee Jones.
Got your mother in a whirl, 'cause she's not sure if you're a boy or a girl. Hey, babe, your hair's all right. Hey, babe, let's stay out tonight. You like me and I like it all. We like dancing in the divine. You know fans when they play it hard. They want more. Rebel, rebel, put on your dress. Rebel, rebel, your face is a mess. Rebel, rebel, how could they know? Hot tramp, I love you so. Sure if you're a boy or a girl. Hey babe, your hair's alright. Hey babe, let's stay out tonight. You like me and I like it all. We like dancing and we look divine. You know fans when they play it hard. You want more and you want it coarse. They put you down, say I'm wrong. So